Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hereinspaziert durch unser Burgtor. Ob Burgherr, Ritterin, Stallbursche oder Gauklerin. Die Burg Liechtenstein in Maria Enzersdorf bei Wien lädt zu Erkundungen ein und weckt bei Groß und Klein die Abenteuerlust. Erbaut im Jahr 1130, ist die Burg bis heute zu 60% im Originalzustand erhalten. Waffenkammer, Turmzimmer und Ritterstube. Die Stammburg der Fürstenfamilie von und zu Liechtenstein bietet Einblicke in das Leben im Mittelalter. Besuchen Sie uns jetzt in der Erlebniswelt Burg Liechtenstein. Jeden Sonntag mit eigener Kinderführung. www.burglichtenstein.eu.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falter Radio. Die Spannung steigt wenige Tage vor dem Wahltag in den USA. Im Finish versucht sich der Amtsinhaber Donald Trump einmal mehr als Rambock gegen das Establishment zu präsentieren. Die Rolle des Streiters gegen die Mächtigen in den Medien und in der Demokratischen Partei hat dem Multimillionär 2016 geholfen, große Teile der weißen Arbeiterschaft auf seine Seite zu bringen. Ein demagogischer Nationalist, 4 Jahre lang an der Spitze der Führungsmacht des Westens, das hat die Welt verändert. Die weißen Amerikaner, vor allem die Männer, werden wahrscheinlich nach wie vor mehrheitlich Trump und die von ihm kontrollierte Republikanische Partei wählen, was eine erschreckende Perspektive ist. Aber insgesamt zeigen die Umfragen knapp vor den Wahlen einen deutlichen Vorsprung des ehemaligen demokratischen Vizepräsidenten Joe Biden. Zu den wichtigsten Leitmedien in den USA zählt die New York Times. Das Traditionsblatt hat in den letzten Jahren die Leserschaft rasant erhöht, vor allem durch digitale Abonnements, durch Podcasts und andere Aktivitäten im Internet. Unter den Aktionären der New York Times hat die Herausgeberfamilie Salzburger das Sagen. Für Donald Trump ist das Blatt der Inbegriff von Fake News, die er beschimpft, weil die New York Times Fakten statt rechten Mythen ins Zentrum stellt und weil im Meinungsteil der New York Times heftig gegen Trump polemisiert wird. Stephen Erlanger ist Europa-Chefkorrespondent der New York Times in Brüssel. Er prägt seit Jahren die außenpolitische Berichterstattung mit Analysen aus allen Teilen der Welt, darunter aus Moskau, aus London, aus Berlin, Jerusalem und Paris. Ich habe Stephen Erlanger im Falter-Interview, das wir in englischer Sprache geführt haben, zuallererst gefragt, wie die amerikanischen Medien mit diesem verrückten Wahlkampf umgehen.
It's a bit of a nightmare, to be honest, because this is a president that runs against traditional media. He runs against the mainstream media. He wants us to be puppets in his puppet show, like Punch and Judy. I mean, he's the one whacking us all the time. And so we play by generally traditional rules. He does not respect those rules. Everything we do is fake news. And of course, he's obsessed with us as well. I mean, Donald Trump is a creature of Queens, New York. He grew up with the New York Times. He has at different points begged us to be nice to him because after all, he's such a success and he came from Queens. And he still speaks to our reporters. But in public, he beats up on us. And everything we write is obviously, in his view, fake and made up and biased. We are part of the swamp that he claims to be draining, though it's hard to find where the drain's going. So it's very complicated. We have become in the last 4 years, I think more, I wouldn't say honest, but more open in saying from time to time that the president is not making a mistake, but is actually lying. But we try to be careful about that because to lie means You know you're lying, as opposed to making a mistake. So it's a word we use very, very carefully. The problem, you know, in a way, is that so many of our readers don't like Trump anyway. It almost doesn't matter what we say. I mean, we've run some extraordinarily intricate reports about Mr. Trump's taxes, for instance. And does it have an effect on the election, on people's view of him? It's very hard to say.
What does it do to the New York Times to be a newspaper that's supposed to give unbiased information? Of course, there is the opinion page, but in the big part of the reporting, it's supposed to be unbiased. Is that possible?
Well, the word we use is objective. And I don't know what objective is exactly. What it means is, in our reporting, you should not be able to know the political opinions of the person writing the report. That we should be fair to both sides, to give all sides a say. Now, there's a whole debate going on inside journalism about what it is to be fair in the face of a president who doesn't care about what's true or what isn't true, maybe no longer can tell the difference, who has been all his life someone who cares about public relations. And even when he was a real estate builder, that's all he was, it was, you know, manipulating the press was part of what they did every day. I mean, there's a famous anecdote about him talking about the number of floors in his famous Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue and telling his people to tell the press it had more floors than it had, because they wouldn't care and they would print it anyway. So it's a problem for us. I think we're trying to hold to an idea of what it is to be fair, what it is to represent the views of his supporters as well as his opponents. But many of our readers, of course, don't make a big distinction between opinion and news. It's very important to us. We have this Berlin Wall, this Chinese wall between news and opinion. But I think many of our readers make no distinction at all.
There's been a discussion about the piece by a Republican senator in the opinion section, Tom Cotton, who was promoting the idea of the president that one should use, if necessary, the military against the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests and the riots. And what the understanding was, there is a split in the among the journalists. I mean, the traditional liberal white older men who argued, well, we should run this kind of articles because we want to present to our readers all the different opinions in society, and then younger black and Latino journalists who said this puts us in danger, it's impossible, and they won, the young people won. Is that
it's a little somehow full, the way you describe it, because there were, you know, some white male reporters who didn't like the piece either, I have to say. I have to be careful here, you know, I'm a reporter. But it is true, it was very divisive within the newspaper. Now, it was an op-ed piece. It was on the opinion side. It was not on the news side. And we, the opinion people, report to the publisher separately from the news people. But they did ask Senator Cotton to write this piece, and it was edited, went through two or three versions, and it did create a tremendous division inside the paper. And in fact, the head of the op-ed opinion section, who is, you know, had a very good career, resigned, was basically pushed out over this in, I think, quite a shocking resignation. He hadn't actually read the piece. He had delegated it to his op-ed editor, who was also on the masthead, who was the highest-ranking Asian-American at the newspaper. He was demoted. His boss was pushed out. And inside the paper, it was, as you say, there was a lot of anger among reporters, especially, who have nothing to do with the opinion pages, many of them Black, who felt that this was somehow putting their lives in danger. And it became a kind of caustic debate inside the paper. And I think the whole thing was not easy. Was it handled well? I wouldn't say. I mean, it was handled. Place goes on. Everyone was reminded to be nicer to one another, inside as well as outside. The publisher, who's quite young, the new publisher, said that in his
name is
A.G. Salzberger. He's
the youngest of the generation.
Exactly, exactly. Who's a very good guy, very smart guy, very good journalist. He said that he did not think the piece should have been written. There are people who said, what's an opinion page for if not to have opinions? And you should have all kinds of opinions. And he's a senator. Tom Cotton was a senator, and he has Trump's ear. So perhaps it was right to publish him. But in the end, we move on.
What's the lesson of that debate? I mean, the political discussion is so polarized now in the U.S. as it probably has never been in the for a long time. And the media have to take a position. Do we give public space to positions like the position of Tom Cotton? I mean, Twitter, the social media, Facebook, are they not in a similar situation because they now start to block tweets or messages or retweets coming from the president itself? What does that mean?
Well, here you're touching on a very important, complicated dilemma, which is social media. Is social, you know, are the publishers of social media, are Facebook and Twitter, are they publishers or are they simply distributors of content? And that's a big debate. They argue that they're like a highway and they're not, it's not their business what travels over the highway, that they're not publishers per se, but they're losing that argument, so much so that Facebook now is talking about maybe we should have government regulation, the way broadcast networks have some sort of government regulation. It's very complicated because Facebook has so many followers. I mean, they could hire half of a city to edit Facebook, and it would be hard to stay on top of everything. So a lot of it is done by algorithm. I mean, they're trying. I think Facebook, you know, I've never been on Facebook. I've never trusted it myself. I've never had a Facebook page. But and I think it's done a lot of damage to local newspapers in America. But I do have some sympathy for their difficulty in controlling the content. I mean, how do you tell the President of the United States that what he's saying should not be broadcast? So what they do now is they put little suggestions that maybe what he's saying isn't necessarily true in each case or is controversial, but this is very much unresolved. And then you have the whole issue of disinformation, of outside influences, Russia, China, Iran, Turkey, playing with these same social media systems. It's easier for the New York Times because we control our content. We make no pretense of giving over our pages to everyone. We edit. Now, we make mistakes. We have had controversies, but we are responsible completely and do not deny that responsibility.
If you watch the debates, the one debate that happened, and then the town hall meetings that happened in Florida and in Philadelphia. As a journalist, as a European journalist, sort of, you are proud of the job these journalists are doing, which is really, really very tough. You have the President of the United States who says, who utters stuff that is clearly doesn't correspond to reality. And I think all of these journalists, they did a great job in order to contradict Trump in the moment when he says something that's obviously false, without making it impossible to continue the discussion. A reaction that also, I mean, seems to be part of journalism that's possible in Fox News, because Chris Wallace, who did the first debate that was considered a catastrophe because everybody was, Trump was actually shouting all the time. I mean, he's from Fox News, but Fox News is also journalistically reacting in the way journalists should act in it.
Some of them, yes. I mean, you know, television is a big church. There are lots of sects in that church. Fox News is very anti-Biden in general. Its editorial content, its talk shows, it has been promoting Trump. As it fears Trump may be losing, it's pulling back a bit. But its news side is a bit different, is much more straightforward. Its Pentagon correspondent, for instance, someone I know, is a very good reporter and got Trump very angry by confirming some of the charges that Trump had called American dead soldiers, losers and suckers, for instance.
Which he did, of course.
Yeah. And that got her into some trouble with Fox's audience. But so, I mean, I respect the people who do this. I don't want to be one of them. I think it's a very difficult job to do, to confront the president without insulting the president, to confront the president without insulting voters. It's very hard to do. And there, we have a reporter in Washington. We have a bunch of them who are doing a very good job, very difficult job. And Peter Baker, Maggie Haberman, they are trying to cover this administration, to be fair, to be decent, to be honest and open with what they're doing. And they do a very good job, and it's complicated. I admire them for trying.
Is there a way for newspapers, mainstream newspapers who care about the truth and facts, to reach the 40% of Trump supporters? Or is that so separate, the public area, that it's impossible? Or do you try? Does the New York Times try?
We try in the sense that we try to report among them. We try to describe what drives them. You know, they are voters, they're citizens. Whether they pay to read us or not is irrelevant so much. I mean, we'd like more and more people to do that. But we learned a big lesson from 2016, where we didn't take the Trump base seriously enough. We didn't take the anger seriously enough. We reported it. It was in the pages, but it didn't have enough prominence in our heads, so much so that, well, of course, even Trump was surprised to win in 2016. He expected to lose. Hillary Clinton expected to win. We expected Hillary Clinton to win. The polls basically expected her to win. But in the aftermath, I think there was a lot of soul-searching in the Democratic Party, to be sure, but also in the mainstream media. How did we miss how close an election it really was? And so we've tried to do much better this time. Do they read us? Sometimes they read us. Sometimes I think people just, you know, on Twitter, they're not even reading, they're just reacting. What's amazing to me about Twitter is, you know, they're, I mean, you know, it can be very funny, it can be very instructive, it can be many things. It also can be very cruel. People find it easy to be cruel on social media in a way they would never be cruel in person. And so there's a kind of ugliness sometimes to it. And you just have to move on. I mean, I think quite often some of our reporters don't even use Twitter. They won't play. I just don't respond to that kind of criticism. It's better. But it's difficult.
You mentioned the polls 4 years ago. I mean, today, superficially, you look at the polls and it seems to replay itself. I mean, Biden is ahead so far. I mean, are the polls better? Do the polls take into consideration the big disaster of polling 4 years ago?
Of course they do. But, you know, every election is different. I mean, what happened essentially last time, which you know, is that the polls thought white males who had not gone to college would vote in the same percentage as before, but they didn't. Many more voted than traditionally. So the polls underplayed that vote, and that vote almost entirely went to Donald Trump. And it became particularly clear in these battleground states, as you know, the way the election runs, the election will come down to 6 or 8 states. That's it. And it will involve, you know, a number of districts in those states. And that's where all the money's going, and that's where the polling is going. And one hopes they're just more accurate. But you see in the battleground states that it's much tighter than in the national polls, because the national polls actually don't mean anything.
Let's talk about the rest of the world. Does the rest of the world play any role in this election campaign? I know in American and presidential election campaigns, usually it's about internal politics, American politics.
And the economy.
The economy, the rest of the world is far away. Does it play a role in this?
I think the rest of the world's pretty far away from the domestic debate. I mean, it will have an impact on the rest of the world. I think it will have certain parts of the world will have an impact. One is the Middle East, which always does, partly because of Jewish voters, but partly because of evangelical Christian voters. And those are more supportive of the Israeli government sometimes than American Jewish voters. And they are very strongly in support of Trump. So when Trump moved the American embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv, that was very, very popular. When his fatherhood, put it that way, of this deal between the United Arab Emirates and Israel, I mean, that was pretty interesting, quite astounding. I think it helps him, again, solidify his base with white Christians, especially, and Christian evangelicals, because Trump's base is largely white and Christian, and increasingly the polarization of American politics is about that the Democratic Party is increasingly urban and minority, and the Republicans are more and more rural or white and Christian. And the big problem for the Republicans is if turnout is big in the cities and the minorities, they will lose this election. So part of what Mr. Trump is trying to do is run against the process to try to suppress the vote or create questions about the validity of the vote.
In the last election, the anti-foreigner theme was very big, anti-Mexican, anti-immigrant. This seems to be less prominent in the election campaign of Trump this time. Is that impression right?
It is right, partly because there has been less of it. I mean, the economic disaster that has followed COVID everywhere has meant fewer people coming to America for jobs, because there are just fewer jobs. Also, the Trump people have tightened up controls on the border. And simply because there are no transatlantic flights, it's very difficult to get into the United States if you're not an American citizen these days. So he has, in general, the Republicans have turned their focus from immigration. They say this is a big victory for Donald Trump, to issues of law and order, of democratic cities that have had protests. We've talked about that, the Black Lives Matter protests, other protests. But of course, with COVID, those protests have declined also. So he's having a harder time with these issues. I mean, he's trying to present Joe Biden as somehow a tool of the radical left in America, who would let, you know, the country go lawless and so on. And I think that's harder for people to believe when things are basically, everyone's hunkered down and worried about getting sick.
I mean, COVID is very much at the center of the discussion and of the campaign. And there is a big difference. In Europe, you have a lot of discussions about COVID. Masks are an issue. Should not underestimate. But masks are an issue for a fringe of the political spectrum and of the public. Whereas in the US, this is a mainstream discussion. Do we need masks? Do we want to have people to have masks or not? Why this big difference?
No, yeah, and you know, even in Europe, it's very hard to get young people to wear masks and keep their distance, right? But it's not political; it's just generational. No, we have such a divided policy, such a divided politics, such a polarized politics. It is a huge issue. It speaks to the competence or incompetence of the President of the United States. But it also speaks to this very odd notion to Europeans that Americans feel, which is the sense of individual freedom. It's one of our great myths. The movement to the West, and, you know, you can move to a new town and start again. It's the idea that government is oppressive. That you should have the smallest government possible, not the biggest government possible. And those people, many of whom, you know, vote Republican, many of whom are in the more rural areas of the United States, they see mask wearing as somehow state control, as a limit on individual freedom. And this is something the president has pushed by his reluctance to wear a mask, because I think, you know, Mr. Trump is very self-conscious always about how he looks and about his masculinity and trying to seem vigorous, even though he's pretty old, even when he was sick. And he hated wearing the mask. He just thought it made him look weak in the face of illness. And this has become a big political issue.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I mean, the fact that the government is seen as oppressive and as a danger to livelihood has always been much stronger, this feeling, in the U.S. than in Europe. But didn't it change with COVID? Because under a pandemic, you want safety. You want to live safe. You want security, safety. And in Europe, you have very clearly all the governments, the prime ministers, presidents get stronger. Their approval ratings are up. Well, now perhaps not anymore because we don't know if they really know how to cope with COVID. But in principle, the idea is the government should take care in order to bring us a certain level of safety in this pandemic. Is that not present in the US?
Well, it is present more on the state level than on the federal level. But, you know, people in general do expect the Centers for Disease Control and the White House to care for the health and safety of Americans, much as they do when a hurricane comes or a typhoon comes and there's a disaster or a big fire, the federal government steps in. Now, there was a lot of incompetence everywhere. I mean, you look around Europe, it's hard to say there were brilliant minds at work, or if they were at work, they weren't figuring it out all that quickly.
You mean East Asia, maybe less incompetence, but that's another story.
Yes, but also with a kind of government involvement that I'm not sure even West Europeans would tolerate. Even what happened in South Korea is the kind of, I mean, they believe in a kind of collective government that I don't think most even Europeans would swallow. But in America, we we don't trust the government very much. But I think this is hurting Trump very badly, the sense that he and his government underestimated the power of this virus. We're not telling the truth about it, and basically made it worse. Now, Trump argues differently. I mean, he argues that it was a great success, and he cut off travel to China quickly. And even though 220,000 people are dead, it would have been much worse without him. Many people disagree. But the fact of the matter is, in a country as big as the United States, with as much transatlantic travel, with no borders among states, this virus was going to spread once it got inside, which is one reason why the European Union shut its borders, by and large, to prevent the virus from spreading, and it's been spreading anyway. So I don't think anyone has the answer, but what has happened in America is, in the middle of an election campaign, it's become a polarizing issue between Republicans and Democrats, which goes to the heart of the competence of this Republican White House. In Europe, it's been more a question to me, looking at France, looking at Germany, Austria, Britain, it's become simply more a question of the competence of leadership rather than socialists versus conservatives.
I mean, the political polarization is extreme in the US now. And this probably has to do with the fact that the Trump people, the Trumpism, seems to be trying to change the political system, to change, go in a more an authoritarian, populist, national system and change the liberal democracy the U.S. has been. On the other side, you have Biden, who seems to follow a line of a big tent. So everybody who does not identify with this Trumpism is supposed to help Biden to vote Biden. Isn't that a weakness? Because this is very defensive. I mean, Biden basically tells us, well, let's defend what we have, and then we see what needs to be changed. And the dynamism of Black Lives Matter, of movements, even the dynamism of the Bernie Sanders campaign seems to have been lost. Is that true?
Well, not entirely, but of course these are things about which everyone has their own opinions. I don't think, I mean, Trump may want to be an authoritarian like Erdogan or Putin or He's a bit of a demagogue, I would say, though I want to be careful saying that. He enjoys that. He loves these rallies, right? But he's not been very successful in changing the American political system. What you have is a very powerful 35% to 40% of the country that supports Trump, that is amused by him, that believes he is standing up for them against the Washington elite, which includes the mainstream newspapers, it includes senators and congressmen. And he's taken over the Republican Party for now because they're afraid of these people, because they are a powerful force within the Republican Party. And the Republican Party also knows that in any straight-up election, it's now a minority party, and it would very likely lose. So they are pushing while they can. They're changing judges. They're changing regulations. They're doing things that do not require voting. And they're trying to get it done so long as they still control the Senate. Now, part of the crucial aspect of this election is not even the presidency, but the Senate, what happens to the Senate. Now, what Biden is trying to do, I mean, I still can't believe, personally speaking, that we have a 77-year-old person running against a 74-year-old person. I mean, it's ridiculous.
In a young country, yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, it's amazing to me. And after Obama, who was another generation, it seems very bizarre to me. But, however, Joe Biden does represent the traditional Democratic Party, which, and his strength, if he beats Trump, it will be because he can appeal to the white male working class that defected from the Democrats in 2016 and voted for Trump. If they come back to Biden, Biden will win the election, because that's Ohio, it's Pennsylvania, it's Michigan, it's Wisconsin. These are the battleground states that Biden needs to win. Now, Biden has also moved somewhat to the left under the pressure of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And, you know, he's given very few, as we say, hostages to fortune about policies. But my guess is that he will be much stronger in trying to provide better health care, in trying to provide better housing, this kind of thing, these traditional Democratic elements. And I think the party will move to the left. The problem for Biden is, to me, he creates very little excitement. You compare an Obama speech to a Biden speech, it's kind of a tragic comparison.
He looks like a decent person, decent senior, knowledgeable, but passion.
Yes. And also, you know, I mean, he's not as articulate as he was 10 years ago. Either is Trump, by the way. But Biden is a decent guy with decent instincts. He appeals more to the Democratic Party. I mean, Biden's whole campaign is based on, I am the anti-Trump. I will bring us back together. I care about the working class. I care about the poor. Trump only pretends to. I will make things better. Now, I think, you know, this worries me, you know, because I don't think it's a very good clarion call for the future. But we'll have to see what happens. And again, as I say, if the Republicans continue to hold the Senate, that will be really, really important. If the Democrats manage to take control of the Senate and win the presidency, then we'll have what we had in the first 2 years of the Obama administration, which is unified government. So a lot of things will get done. In the last 6 years of the Obama administration, when the Republicans took control of the Senate, it was very difficult to get anything done. And so I think this is crucial. Because we are, as you know very well, a system of checks and balances.
One question on foreign policy and American-European relations. Obviously, Trump was trying to to get out of international deals, trying to weaken international organizations, international alliances with this idea of America first, America only. If we get a Biden administration, will it be possible to go back to the situation before this idea and this destructive activity of American diplomacy?
Well, I don't think you can ever go back, first of all. I mean, the rise of China changes the world. It had nothing to do with Donald Trump, right? It was going to happen anyway. What happens in Russia is going to happen whether Trump exists or doesn't exist. What's happening in Hungary or Poland has nothing to do with Donald Trump. So the world is different. Biden will be like a warm bath in the past for many European leaders because it will be very easy in the beginning. There'll be nice words. He'll rejoin the Paris Climate Accords. He'll rejoin the World Health Organization. He'll talk about how to reform the World Trade Organization with the Europeans. He may try to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. He'll pay America's share for UNRWA, which is the agency that aids Palestinian refugees. All these things Trump has pulled out of, and he will believe, he will say the right words about multilateralism and about NATO and so on and so on. But there will be significant skepticism on the part of Europeans in a few ways. One, he will be 78 years old, and American polarization has affected foreign policy as well. It used to be American foreign policy was consistent. It is no longer consistent. And every European leader will know that Joe Biden may be only a one-term president, and we might have a Tom Cotton or another hardline Republican who is a better politician than Trump, perhaps, or younger, certainly, who could be back in 4 years and turn things upside down all over again. So commitments will feel contingent. I think Europeans will be asked to do things by Biden. It would be very hard to say no to Biden when you could say no to Trump, but there'll be nervousness about taking too big a risk, let's say, with China, if you think that 4 years from now, there'll be a whole reversal again. So that's one problem. And the second problem, I would say, is, you know, European Union has been agonizing for a long time about issues, strategic autonomy, its own voice in the world, Europe as a power. Believe in it or not, I tend to worry it'll never happen. But Emmanuel Macron of France, who's been the one pushing it hardest, has benefited from the Trump years to argue there's a vacuum in American leadership, that Europe must stand on its own 2 feet, that Europe must defend its own security interests because Trump hates NATO and so on and so on. If Biden wins, it's going to be much harder for him to make that argument. And many people feel European leaders will just put their heads back into the sand or back into the warm embrace of a democratic president.
The perspective that you mentioned is that Trumpism may not be over after a possible defeat of Trump. And this, of course, has to do with the fact that he sort of represents a mass movement. I mean, you have really, his rallies are not as big as he says himself, but they are big. And these 35 to 40% of people who support him, they will stay. And my question is, this combination of far-right politicians in the Senate, now a far-right president, and a radicalization on the base, isn't that something that may be called the fascism of our time? Because part of this radicalization are violent people, are militias, and the whole conglomerate here is changing the relationship of forces in the society. Are we in a situation where you have to say, okay, the U.S. society is destabilized in a certain way, politically, economically, and we have for the next decade, perhaps for a long time, a proto-fascist, radicalized mass movement plus corresponding political leaders.
Well, first of all, I don't use the word fascism. I think it's much misused. I mean nothing personal, but Ernst Nolte wrote a very good book about the three phases of fascism, none of which apply to the United States of America. Fascism is not, I mean, there isn't a corporatism, there's not a Mussolini. I'm not worried about fascism in America. But you're talking about structural change in the way some Americans feel about their government and about the world. And I agree with you there that there is disappointment and anger. The American dream has proved to be hollow for many people. Middle-class incomes have stagnated. People are angry about that. People feel their views are not being represented. It's something similar to the identitarian politics that we see sometimes in Europe, where what is it to be a real American? What is it to be a real Hungarian, a real Austrian, a real Pole? That's a very political question. It's a cultural and political question, and it's a real question, and it's a question that perhaps politicians have not dealt with sufficiently in a world of globalization and social media and blah, 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 blah. But these are serious issues. And Americans, I think, for a long time have felt, and Trump has touched on this, but this was something that Republicans and Democrats have argued before, which is that our allies take advantage of us, that they do not pay their fair share, that they are free riding on American taxpayers. Now, Trump has touched on that. That's not going to change. That's a view, and that's a view Democrats hold. And there's another change, which is China, which is another bipartisan concern in America that I don't think is felt so strongly in Europe. Europe is not the peer competitor of China the way America is, but there is a sense of not just rivalry, but that China is out for supremacy. Xi Jinping says that China is out for supremacy by 2050, if not before. And it's not the Soviet Union. It's a very sophisticated country in terms of its technology and its computer knowledge and its hacking ability, its control of its society. Its ambitions are more regional, it seems to me. And I'm not someone who's terribly afraid of China. But in America, there is a real sense that until Donald Trump, governments were much too passive in the face of the rise of China. And there'll be pressure on Europe to come along for the ride, which will be very uncomfortable, I think, given that China is the European Union's second largest trading partner next to the United States. So yes, there are changes in the United States. We've had a populist tradition that goes back a long way, as you know, to William Jennings Bryan. And before, we've had racial politics, and we've had all kinds of problems. This is not a country with a very peaceful history. But I am not really worried about some totalitarian America emerging, personally. I hope I'm right.
Sie hörten aus der Falter Werkstatt ein Gespräch mit Stephen Erlanger, dem Europa-Chefkorrespondenten der New York Times, das wir Mitte November in Wien geführt haben. Erlanger war für eine Amerika-Diskussion im Burgtheater auf Einladung des Instituts für die Wissenschaften von Menschen nach Wien gekommen. Bei den Kolleginnen und Kollegen des Instituts bedanke ich mich sehr herzlich für die Unterstützung. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW hören, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Der Falter bietet nicht nur viel Kultur, viel Neues aus der Stadt Wien und aus der heimischen Innenpolitik, sondern immer auch einen Blick über den Tellerrand hinaus, jede Woche. Daher ist ein Abonnement des Falter der beste Weg, informiert zu sein. Ein Abo bestellt man am besten im Internet über die Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet. Anna Goldenberg und Miriam Hübel betreuen die Audiotechnik. Ich verabschiede mich bis zur nächsten Folge.
Sie hörten das Falterradio, den Podcast mit Raimund Löw.